When I began searching for a story, I had not imagined any particular part of the country that I wanted to study, but I knew that I was after something local, because good stories are by their nature local and full of context. The orphan story also attracted me because it offered what history is particularly good at, making connections, especially counterintuitive ones, tying the big to the small, the momentous to the insignificant. I love its incongruities. You have Scottish and old New England capital drawing Mexican workers into the Arizona Territory. You have the New York Sisters of Charity confronting the Wild West. You have a copper mining barony involved in a dispute over mixed race adoption. And you have a vigilante action organized by women. These linkages are, of course, related to the feminist understanding that the personal is political, but also to the larger intellectual and emotional task of negotiating and living with the tension between personal agency and larger structural constraints. In choosing a story to tell, I was also, however, seeking certain themes, notably intersections between family and racial issues. The story is foremost a tale of racial formation. I have been really lucky to be a working historian now at a moment when thinking about race has developed very rapidly in a new direction. Despite the continuing and in some areas much worsening racisms throughout the world, global racial diversity, notably in the U.S., is challenging traditional understandings of race as a natural categorization, challenging it, I think, not in order to deny the social power of race, but in order to contest racism. So the orphan story offers a chance to see how racial ideas change, as well as the passion that arises around them. And it also offered a chance to see the role of family values in constructing race. Within the new critical race theory and the so-called whiteness studies, gender and family have only just begun to be integrated. The revived women's history of the 1970s has emphasized first, the activism of women who were blotted out of history, and second, the complex historical forms of women's oppression and subordination. Then, as racism became a theme in the analysis of women's past, historians discovered also how some women, with the privilege of white skin, excluded and even exploited women of color. My book is just an attempt to add another dimension, an exploration of the ways that family relationships themselves have helped construct racial lines and racism. Not exclusively, probably not even primarily. In subordinating Mexican to Anglo people in the Southwest, it was Anglo land greed, U.S. military campaigns, and great corporate employers who were probably far more powerful than the community activism of Anglo women. But these women made their contribution. The definitions of whiteness in the Southwest revolved in very large part on redefining class respectability in terms of white styles of dress, housing, language, deportment, matters in which women governed. Consider, for example, one of the funnier aspects of this female control of class and race cultures. Before the women came to the Southwest, many of the local structures in this area were made of adobe, a traditional and practical building material. But by the early 20th century, Anglos had learned to despise adobe as a coarse and primitive material. Then, of course, in the next decades, as Anglo tourists, intellectuals, and bohemians came to visit and settle in the Southwest, adobe became once again fashionable. Before the 1890s, when Anglo women came in large numbers to Arizona, Mexican Anglo intermarriage was common, and it was entirely respectable. Its decline was not just due to the increased supply of white women, but to an active campaign to make intermarriage disreputable. And that campaign rested to a considerable degree on maligning the virtue of Mexican women. The Anglo women's insistence that white children could not live in Mexican families was like another anti-miscegenation law, this one targeting not intermarriage, but family formation through adoption. In patrolling the borders of family relationships, the Anglo women built a wall around whiteness and then helped construct what became a complete apartheid that dominated Clifton-Morenci by 1920. The degree of segregation in that place at that time was easily as complete and total as it was in Mississippi. We need to register that this racial system developed as much in women's sphere, in family and in social life, as it did in the mines. Nowhere were the passions that justified this segregation and hierarchy as great as they were when the subject was family and children. Another layer of complexity had to do with understanding the women's motives. When I first found this story, it seemed to me like a mystery, with the outcome and the perpetrators known. My job was to find the motives. And even beyond that, to try to find out how the women had come to have these motives. And the solution I found required acknowledging multiple and even contradictory motives. The historical critiques of the women's racism that we have developed have not yet been adequate, I think, in exploring the ways in which the very same women could be simultaneously struggling for and against justice. I think this can happen because whole cultures have been so saturated with racialized thought that many people could be simultaneously fighting against their own subordination while stepping on others, or to put it in reverse, that even the villains could have some virtuous motives. And the Clifton story, I think, shows us that perspective. And in that dimension, it continues a vital theme and an ongoing problem for me in writing as a so-called public intellectual: the often perverse and negative outcomes of good intentions and the complex ways that various forms of domination interrelate. It does not yield simple stories. So let me just reconsider, once again, the motives in the orphan story. The prime movers in these events were all women. The book is about initiatives taken by three groups of women: the New York Sisters of Charity, the Arizona Mexican Women, and the Arizona Anglo Women, each of whose motives were, from their own perspective, impeccable. In that sense, I consider this a tragedy. Each group had at heart the best interests of the children. The nuns wanted to save their souls. The Mexican women wanted to bring them from an impersonal orphanage into the warmth of a family. And the Anglo women wanted to save them from child neglect. But none of these groups was free in forming its own motives. None of them could see the children in a manner that we might call objective. Furthermore, there was nothing unusual about their bias. The entire history of the concept of the best interests of the child is ridden with ambiguity, with bias, and injustice. Cultural, racial, religious, and class differences have a way of making parents from disadvantaged groups seem inferior to parents in privileged groups. Clifton Morenci was not the only site where children were rescued without evidence that the children were in fact endangered. Between 1910 and 1975, white Australians stole 100,000 children from their Aboriginal parents, giving the light-skinned children to white couples to adopt and the dark-skinned children to orphanages. In Israel, Ashkenazi, that is, European Jewish women, with the help of doctors throughout the 1930s, 40s, 50s, even into the 1960s, stole children from maternity hospitals, babies born to Sephardic, mostly Yemeni Jewish women. Inuit and other Native American children were forcibly removed from their families by U.S. and Canadian governments. Conservative Argentinian elites were certain that they were right to seize babies from women in the democracy movement. In these cases, the children usually ended up in homes with more resources, better educations, and greater comforts than their original parents could provide. Being raised as white in most societies is a considerable advantage. For most of U.S. history, it was better to be raised Protestant than Catholic or Jewish. But the implications are disturbing. Does this mean that if the prosperous somehow manage to get control of poor children, they should be able to keep them in preference to their poor parents? Does it follow that in any custody dispute, the parents with superior education, higher status, better neighborhoods, and good medical care should win? That we should rescue children such as Elian Gonzalez, doomed because they're doomed to live with their parents in unfree countries? Elian Gonzalez's is not a unique case even today. Over the last three decades, there has been a pronounced increase in the removal of children from their parents by court order, and these are overwhelmingly poor parents and parents of color. In New York City, for example, in 1973, 17% of children placed in foster care had been removed from their parents by court order, and 83% were surrendered voluntarily. Today, in New York City, 95% of those removed from their parents are removed by court order. Some of these children were endangered and were removed for the sake of their safety. But generally, researchers estimate that approximately 10% of the child removals stem from abuse, 40% from neglect, and 50% from home problems, which should probably be attributed to the parents' lack of resources rather than to willful neglect. Now, the reason for the particular narrative strategy I chose in this book was to attempt to expose the unfreedom, you might call it, and the biases that shaped the Anglo women's certainty that they knew what was good for the children. Doing that required context. I first thought about this story in the manner of William Blake's notion that a grain of sand can reveal the whole world. But the converse is equally true, that the entire history of America is implicated in these women's motives. None of their actions would have been the same had it not been for slavery, for the Civil War and the end of slavery, for the U.S. conquest of the Indian Territory, the fierce resistance of the Apaches and their final imprisonment on their reservations, the U.S. annexation of half of Mexico, the energy and determination of the westward Anglo settlers, the rapid expansion of the railroads, the skyrocketing industrialization, which created a geometrically multiplying demand for copper, and the politics of Arizona's drive for statehood, the campaign for woman suffrage, and even the first Mexican demands for democracy, which were going to give rise a few years later to the Mexican Revolution. Equally importantly, the women's motives also derive from very personal experiences, the kind that rarely make the history books, from the church services they attended, their housekeeping, child raising, recreation, and entertainment patterns. Understanding these women even required that the reader learn a bit about hard rock mining, about vigilantism, about the Phelps Dodge Corporation, and about the miners' struggles for safety and a living wage. All these things shaped their motives, and I tried to show how. It's a complicated story, and I don't have time to tell it all, but here is just a very distilled part of it. The Sisters of Charity wanted to mother motherless children, but also to save them from the sin the nuns perceived in the homes of their poor mothers, frequently unmarried, almost always without husbands, often, in the view of the nuns, disreputable. Creating the orphanage had been also, however, part of the sisters' own struggle to get out from under the thumb of the male church hierarchy. And their power over the orphans was in some ways compensatory for the power they lacked in the church. They were determined that their guardianship over these children would protect the faith. The Mexican women also wanted to mother motherless children, and to prove their devotion through this act of charity, a very expensive act for such poor women. By taking in the orphans, they sought to please their priest, to support their church, and to express their devotion. But their initiative in agreeing to take these children, and it was distinctly their initiative, not their husbands, was simultaneously part of a move to claim an area of female authority in a very male-dominated culture and place. The Anglo women also wanted to mother motherless children, children they saw as motherless even after they were placed with Clifton families, because, of course, they simply could not imagine that Mexican women could be adequate mothers to white children. They believed that leaving the children with the Mexicans constituted child abuse, and that not to rescue them would have represented a dereliction of female duty. They, too, used the orphan incident to claim a sphere of authority in the macho culture of a mining camp. In fact, all three of these groups of women were pursuing what I consider citizenship. By citizenship here, I mean not what passport you carry, but claiming rights and claiming voice in the community in which one lives. Excluded from citizenship by their churches, by the law, by the corporate economy, they manufactured their own citizenship when and how and where they could. Lacking the vote, they nevertheless became significant political actors. In New York City by 1904, the church was a major political player, and its institutional power depended on the free labor of nuns, who were well aware of the church's dependence on them. The sisters frequently defied the male hierarchy and got away with it. Their leaders, the leaders of the New York Foundling Hospital, were often in direct negotiation with the governor of New York State and the mayor of New York City regarding the subsidies the Sisters of Charities received for taking in the children. What could be better proof of their achievement of citizenship? In Clifton Morenci, Anglo women had been primarily responsible for community development, the establishment of schools, of clubs, of choruses, of theatrical societies, of waste disposal and other disease-fighting public health reforms, of law and order against prostitution, drunkenness, and violence. They too made direct demands of the government and pressured Phelps Dodge to clean up its pollution. Mexican women in Clifton Morenci were the mainstay of the church, of the fundraising efforts of the Mexican fraternal societies, of what education was available to the Mexican kids, and of struggles for social and moral respectability and against prostitution, drunkenness, and violence. All three groups operated both by struggling against and by allying with, as necessary, the men of their group, of their class, of their race. The three groups of women had remarkably similar priorities in their community activism. A New York Times reviewer criticized me for feminist utopianism, for pointing to these bases of potential solidarity, and I plead guilty. I think the bases were there. All three groups of women conducted daily reconnaissance in Clifton Morenci against the snakes, the spiders, and the scorpions. They all cursed Phelps Dodge for the murky, silty water they had to use, no matter how well-to-do they were. Even the upper-class Anglo mothers were helpless when their children died from the waves of typhus and typhoid. They all hated the raucous violence in and around the saloons, and they all knew that the violence sometimes came home with the men, along with the venereal disease. The potential was there for that unity, but so was the potential for exclusion. Let me return just briefly to the end of the story, the trial. In referring to the posse, the courts, the newspapers, and the white Arizonans all said, "The citizens of Arizona decided to take back the babies," or even, "The people of Clifton have decided." Who were these so-called citizens who demanded and won the children? Why did they speak of taking back children they had never possessed? What was the source of their absolute confidence in their legitimacy as citizens and the righteousness of what they were doing? The trial in Phoenix in January of 1905 was the event of the decade. A packed courtroom with the governor and many local politicians in attendance every day. In this trial, every single one of the 27 witnesses, the lawyers for both sides, the judges, and the newspaper reporters were in perfect agreement about who the citizens were. There was an erasure here truly breathtaking in its audacity. Throughout the trial, not one single Mexican voice was heard. No Mexican witness was called, no affidavit from a Mexican was introduced, no Mexican sat in the audience, no Mexican was interviewed by a journalist. Since both sides of the trial were Anglo, the Foundling Hospital and the vigilantes, the effect was not only to reinforce the white line encircling citizenship in Arizona, but to make the Mexicans seem so far outside that circle as to be literally of no account. Now, there had been a form of democracy in this posse, containing, as it did, the highest and the lowest among the Anglos of Clifton. In South Africa, this has sometimes been called a herrenvolk democracy, a democracy of the ruling men. Membership in the people had nothing to do with place of birth or naturalization. Many of the citizens were, in fact, aliens, and many of the Mexicans were legal citizens of the United States. There was a similar ruling women's democracy in the Anglo women's group. They had a special kind of membership in the citizenry, exempt from and not eligible for military duty or jury or posse service. They were nevertheless full voting members, even officers of this citizenry, in the decision-making body that met in the library hall that day, despite their legal disenfranchisement. Indeed, the orphan incident helped build their citizenship, because through it they practiced, improved, and demonstrated their organizational skills, their articulateness, their public confidence. In some ways, they were doing the work of the Copper Company in a different sphere. They were erasing class. They did this by ignoring, however temporarily, the class differences among the Anglos. The female ringleaders included the highly educated hotel owner's wife and an uneducated butcher's wife who spoke with poor grammar. Their husbands included a German-Jewish investor from the East, a saloon owner, and a mining foreman, not to mention the delivery man. They performed a symmetrical erasure of class among the Mexicans, denying the existence of class differences among them, treating them all as an underclass. It is not just that the women were separated by their race, their language, and their mutual prejudices. The Anglo women not only excluded Mexicans, but they actually built their citizenship on Mexican backs. Their activism rested on the work of Mexican maids whom they could afford because Mexican wages were so low. Their so-called public schools were made cheaper for the taxpayers by excluding the Mexican children. Their husbands were kept safe by assigning to the Mexicans the most dangerous job in this most dangerous of all occupations, mining. And their husbands' wages, of course, rested on the super exploitation of Mexicans in the wage system and then again in the company store. These women were not stupid. They understood the political economy in which they lived. They wished the Mexicans well, they thought, and they had no objection to Mexican uplift, but they instinctively drew back from measures which might have improved the status of the Mexicans relative to their own. Now, I do not mean to attribute the Anglo's response to these orphans strictly to a kind of narrowly conceived economic self-interest, although it is awfully coincidental that anti-Mexican racism intensified radically in Clifton-Morenci, precisely in sync with the rise of the mines and the prosperity that depended on cheap labor. It's more accurate, though, I think, to say that the political economy of the region seized upon existing racialized thinking and used it to great profit. But these Anglo women were by no means passive. Their energy and persuasiveness was remarkable. Consider that they not only organized the kidnapping of the children, commanding, as it were, a posse, that they not only developed the legal case that enabled them to keep the children, but they then drew the highest court in the country into ratifying that injustice on the grounds of the best interests of the children. So I am speaking here of citizenship as a great political achievement and of women's aspirations for citizenship, for a public voice, as the noblest of struggles. But the definitions of citizenship and of the public sphere have also been used to exclude. That's what the so-called citizens of Clifton-Morenci achieved. The trial was a great public event, yet we must remember who its public was. Not a single Mexican belonged to that public, apparently. If we're to create an all-inclusive citizenship in the future, perhaps the orphan story can remind us that not only is sexual inequality created in the so-called private sphere, but also that race and class exclusions from citizenship are created in the sphere of family as well as in that of the police and the legislatures. Thank you.
Linda, I greatly enjoyed the lecture, and I wanted to draw you out a little bit more on this issue of the political voice or voicelessness of the Mexican community. I mean, when you listen to the story and the evidence that you're giving, I mean, the question that I'm asking is not so much why was there no cross-ethnic solidarity, because it's not clear to me if we should be talking about this as an ethnic slash national issue or as a racial issue, particularly vis-a-vis the Mexicans. But there are some pieces of the puzzle which I'm sure historically can be filled in. What is the origin of the Mexican community in Arizona? Were they there? Were they brought in? Were some there? Were some brought in? What is their history of incorporation? The war with Spain was not all that old. And you said, for example, that some of the vigilantes were themselves aliens who then became citizens in a formal sense. And some of the Mexicans were full U.S. citizens, but who were completely disempowered. Well, there is this border situation of almost, you know, now becoming the national of a country with which your own country has had a war. There are all sorts of issues of allegiance. And in a way, the Catholic Church, I mean, there is the question also, the other side of Catholicism is that it does not recognize boundaries. It is a community of faith. And in some sense, it also posed a challenge to civic identity, right? I mean, in accepting these family status as foster parent families, at the same time, there was a kind of community of faith which was transcending the boundaries of whatever civic citizenship issues may have been there. So if you could just
I have lots to say about this. I could talk about this for another hour, but I won't. I'll try to be brief. First, about the religious issue. Of course, in theory, the Catholic Church is an international community. But in fact, there was a specific Catholic Church here, and it was a French church, and it was run from St. Louis and from Paris. And it was not the same church that was run from New York, which is the Irish church. And during the trial, there was a tremendous amount of conflict between the Bishop of Tucson, who is the big shot in this region, and the guys in New York, who are the Irish, and a lot of animosity. And the Bishop of Tucson's view was that the New Yorkers had used his priest as a scapegoat, which there's some truth in that. So we really have to think about the church, the very local organization. There was, for example, in the whole entire American Southwest, there was not a single Mexican priest, and there wasn't a Mexican priest for yet a couple of decades. The vast majority of these people were, at least of the people over, say, age 25, were born in Mexico. And these people consider themselves Mexicans. And the reason I call them Mexicans and not Mexican Americans or anything else is because that's what they called themselves, and that's what everyone called them. And they were, although they were quite far from the border, this is not a border town, it's about 150 miles to the border, they were absolutely a binational people because their economy, their personal lives, and their culture was in every way involved a binational existence, though they wouldn't even have thought about it that way because the borderline, there was no border, there was no INS, there was no border patrol at this time. Often single men came, leaving relatives or wives to try to keep going the little ejidos that they had in Mexico. Actually, there were actually more Mexicans in Clifton Morenci lived in families than so-called white guys did. More of the Anglos were still these kind of transient minors without families. But the point is that the identity of the Mexican people doesn't easily fit into the categories that were used by Anglos, and that's part of what, you know, there's a long discussion in the book about precisely that issue, and it's precisely why the word race is certainly not a word or any proximate translation of it that the Mexican people themselves used. They probably, if anything, would have called themselves something closer to a people, which is another very ambiguous term because it has a lot, it fuses religion, it fuses geography, it fuses nation, and it fuses some sense of what we might call an ethnicity or a race. Right? It's just very complex.
Thank you all for your wise and insightful questions.
You've been listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals, programming from the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. The Institute invites your comments on the series, Feminisms and the Practice of Democracy, via their website at www.radcliffe.edu/feminisms. The producer for this series is Laura Ross-Kos, director of the Graduate Consortium in Women's Studies. Thank you for joining us.